as indicated in the letter of support, the commission is jointly funding the project with the Ohio State Bar Foundation. Professor Hirsch is the director for the Program on Data and Governance at the Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. We've worked together before, Professor Hirsch and I have, on a couple different things, so it was a pleasure to hear from him and talk about the possibility of moving this project forward. We all hear so much about risk assessment, and it seemed like a particularly good time to learn more about how risk assessment is used, especially as we're venturing down the road of the development of the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform, and think that it is all connected. So Professor Hirsch, I'll turn it over to you to talk more specifically about the work and the timeline and whatever else you'd like to talk to the group about this morning.
Terrific, thanks, Sarah. I will, you know, share with the group some information about the project, just give you a bit of background, tell you what we're up to and what we're going to do. And then I'll try and reserve some time at the end for your questions and discussion. Actually, I have some questions of you, some things I'd like to get your input on that would be useful. But let me start by telling you about the project, and I'm going to share some slides to do that. So as was mentioned, we're calling this project Aligning Algorithmic Risk Assessments with Criminal Justice Values. And as I'm sure you all know, you know, an algorithmic risk assessment, sometimes called the Risk Assessment Instrument or RAI, employs an algorithm to assess a defendant's future risk for misconduct. And these risk assessments can inform either pretrial or post-trial decision-making by the court, or both. And the Ohio Risk Assessment System, or ORAS, is an example of this type of risk assessment instrument. And there are a number of others that are in use around the country. So those, you know, proponents of risk assessment would say that they provide a number of benefits to the criminal justice system. They increase consistency of judicial decision-making. They can increase accuracy of judicial decision-making according to a number of studies. Statistical models can outperform unaided human decisions in this area. They can actually be, depending on their design and depending on what is disclosed, they can be more transparent. In the sense that, you know, the human mind is something that we can't see working as well unless a judge, you know, articulates an opinion. But if you have a kind of simple checklist style tool, at least the components can be very transparent to the defendant and others involved in the proceeding. They can help courts to reduce the use of cash bail, and they can help courts facilitate alternatives to confinement. Young et al. In a 2020 study showed that 30% fewer defendants were detained with the use of an algorithmic risk assessment without increasing the risk of pretrial misconduct. Of course, as is true with the Ohio risk assessment system and other such instruments, you know, the judges don't just defer to these risk assessment recommendations. It informs judicial decision-making. It doesn't replace it. So proponents would argue these are some of the benefits of this. But as you've probably heard, you know, these instruments are also controversial across a number of different fronts. One is risk of bias in the way that these risk assessments make their recommendations, or in the recommendations that they make. There's a very high profile report on the Compass risk assessment instrument done by ProPublica, which showed that while the tool assessed risk with equal accuracy across races. When it was wrong, it erred more in favor of a false positive for African Americans and a false negative for whites. And so that was seen to be incorporating bias. And this is something that we see with some frequency when it comes to algorithmic decision-making tools, not only in the criminal justice area, but elsewhere, which is to say that the tool is only as fair as the data on which it is trained. So if there's bias baked into the data, then the tool will likely learn bias unless it is corrected. And an example here might be that there are studies showing that African Americans are arrested for marijuana use with greater frequency than whites, even though the rate of illegal marijuana use is similar for both races. And so if marijuana arrests were part of the data that was used to assess future risk, that bias in the arrest frequency would then be replicated and perpetuated in the risk assessment. And so that's the type of thing that one wants to be sensitive to. So bias is one area of controversy with respect to these tools. Opacity is another, especially where the vendor asserts trade secret claims over the algorithm and the specific components going into it. And so a prosecutor or a defense lawyer cannot challenge the algorithm, can't see it, even though it is figuring into the decision, or perhaps cannot know what data is being used of the defendant to inform this risk assessment and can't challenge that. And so this opacity, especially in the judicial criminal justice context, where due process is such an important value and norm, raises important issues. Some are concerned that the algorithmic recommendation will be given too much weight and will override a judge's experience and judgment, and on which we rely so heavily. And finally, there have been allegations that judicial decision-making, criminal justice decision-making, like sentencing decisions, for example, is supposed to be based on the characteristics of the individual defendant. Whereas an algorithmic tool necessarily puts the individual into a group. And so in the case of Loomis versus Wisconsin, which went before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, this was alleged to be a violation of due process. The court ultimately rejected that claim, but this has been another area of controversy with respect to these tools. So the question becomes then, since Ohio is using algorithmic risk assessments, how to align its use of these tools with its own criminal justice values? Because, lack of bias, fairness, the ability to challenge, the evidence or witnesses against you, if we can call these tools a witness, transparency and due process. These are very dear values of our own criminal justice system. So these controversies, are not alien to the Ohio criminal justice system. They implicate some of its most important values. And so then that really raises the question, how to align the use of these risk assessments with the criminal justice system's own values, fairness, due process, justice, et cetera. And this is actually, for me, a rather familiar question in the area that I work in with the Program on Data and Governance. We are also often looking at new and emerging technologies, algorithms, AI, et cetera, and thinking, how do these new technologies raise challenges to some of our core values? And insofar as they do, how do we channel such technology so that they better align with our values? And we see this in many areas, not just the criminal justice system. And so I think this is this question of how to think about this and how to do this is to be expected in some ways when you have a new technology playing an important role in society. And of course, one of the main ways that we align new technologies with our social values is through law and policy and guidance. Those are very familiar tools for doing this. And there's an opportunity to do that here. And it's important when we use law and policy to do this, that we do so in a proactive, thoughtful, and deliberate way. And that's how we get the best results. That is inclusive of many stakeholders and, you know, really is done carefully. Not, you know, to do this in response to litigation, which is what the Wisconsin Supreme Court faced in the wake of, you know, or in its Loomis decision. In that litigation, it articulated some guidelines for how Wisconsin should use the Compass risk assessment tool and how judges should use them. That's not the optimal way to go about defining such policies and guidance. You want to do it proactively. And that leads us to our research project. And that's really the goal, core goal of our research project is to assist Ohio with being proactive about its policies and guidance with respect to these risk assessments. So we're going to do this, first of all, by studying the best practices. We're going to look at other states that are using risk assessments and the types of guidance and the types of rules that they've set out, as well as the scholarly literature and what it has to say, and think tanks and white papers, and really gather all of this. So a literature review is an important first step to understanding the best practices. Then we really need to understand what's happening in Ohio. You know, how are Ohio courts using these tools? And we'll do that both through interviews and a survey. And our goal is to have all Ohio districts represented and also have a nice representation of larger jurisdictions, smaller jurisdictions, urban, rural, et cetera. So we really get a nice cross-section and a sense of how these tools are being used in Ohio courts. We think it's also important to engage stakeholders. And so we want to do, or we plan to do and will do, focus groups that bring together a number of stakeholders to get their views, their hopes for what risk assessments can achieve and their concerns about, you know, the effects that such risk assessments have in the criminal justice system. So we're thinking about judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, victim rights advocates, civil rights advocates, Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, et cetera. And one of the things I'd like your feedback on, as I will ask later, is, you know, who should be included in that list of stakeholders. Another thing I'll ask for your input on, going back to, you know, the interviews and survey of the Ohio courts is, you know, how do we best enlist judges in responding to our survey and agreeing to our interviews and feeling that this is something that will be beneficial to their work and not a hindrance. So, you know, I would appreciate your input on that. But we will study the best practices, we'll study the current practice, we'll engage stakeholders and get their views, and then we will, in the analysis, apply best practices to the Ohio practice in light of stakeholder views, and from that develop recommendations. And Sarah, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that in the first instance, at least, we will be submitting our recommendations to the Criminal Sentencing Database Governance Board.
Yes. And then the commission over that, yes.
Okay. So some of the initial questions that we want to explore in this research is, you know, which courts are using algorithmic risk assessments and for which decisions, you know, for bail decisions, for sentencing decisions, et cetera. And then how do judges actually incorporate these risk assessments into their decision-making? To what extent do they give them weight? How much weight do they give them? Why do they give them weight? Why might they give them less weight? What do judges say about that? What's actually happening on the ground? Because while there has been quite a bit of research into the risk assessments themselves, there's been very little into how they're actually implemented and put into practice. So we'd like to learn more about that. Are they being used differently for pretrial than post-trial by judges? Are judges using them differently for different types of crimes? What do judges understand about how these risk assessments work and how they, you know, create their recommendations? How are judges being trained in the use of algorithmic risk assessments? How should they be trained? How should the state balance transparency, due process, and intellectual property, the intellectual property rights of the vendors, right? So we want more transparency. We want more ability to understand and challenge these recommendations. How do we balance that with the intellectual property rights of the vendors? And are there any data that are so biased that they should be excluded from this type of tool? And this becomes particularly relevant when we think about the creation of the criminal sentencing database that the commission is working on right now. And that will, likely be used to inform these risk assessments either now or in the future. So, you know, we need to think about, are there any data that are so biased that we really don't want them at part of this type of decision-making? What does the literature have to say about that? Why do this now? Well, one reason is the creation of the criminal sentencing database that will generate more data and so that will likely be used for these risk assessments. And so it's important to think about this now and be proactive about it. Generally, it's important to proactively address the concerns about these tools rather than, you know, face them later in litigation or through some other type of challenge. It's better to kind of get in front of this and try and use these tools in the most careful and responsible way. And as I mentioned, there are a few studies of how algorithmic risk assessments are used in practice. So this study will be a valuable addition to the literature and valuable for the state in thinking about how it wants to use these tools. As Sarah already mentioned, we are able to do this through the support of this commission. So I thank you on behalf of the Moritz College of Law and Ohio State for the support that your organization has given to this research, and also the Ohio State Bar Foundation has given essentially a matching grant so that we have been able to fund and carry out this project. Our research team starts with the faculty from the Moritz College of Law that are involved in this, myself, and I direct the program on data and governance. I teach privacy law. Doug Berman, who many of you may know, is really the leading authority on criminal sentencing. And Rick Simmons, who teaches criminal procedure and has been writing about the use of algorithms in the criminal justice system, will also be involved. From our program, Dr. Pragati Rawat is our new employee who's starting in July. Very excited to have her. And she brings a lot of experience in interview and survey methodology. And this project will be one of her first principal assignments to work on. We are able to draw on other university faculty from the departments of computer science and sociology, a number of whom have already expressed interest. So we would like to draw on their expertise. And as I understand it, the commission's own leadership and staff, including Sarah and Nikki Hotchkiss and Todd Ives, are going to support and be involved in this project as well. And we welcome their help with this. I'm gonna stop sharing for a second so I can just pull up this timeline that I wanna show you. One moment. So this is the timeline for our research. You can see, we've been hiring our senior research associate. We're going to start soon the literature review work. We're going to start soon working with the commission staff on identifying the judges and stakeholders that we should start to engage with, that we will ultimately engage with. We're going to start the survey design work. We'll move through to the promotion and distribution of the survey and interviews, carrying out the individual interviews, disseminating and collecting data from the survey. We'll do focus groups with stakeholders. And then into the beginning of next year, we'll start with the data analysis and report writing. And we will finalize and deliver the report to the commission by May of next year. So that's our plan for a year-long study. Are you seeing my slides again? Yeah, okay. I just end with a quote from the Berkman Center for Internet Law and Society at Harvard. They did a very nice study they called Assessing the Assessments, Lessons from Early State Experiences with Risk Assessment Tools. This is back in 2018. But they say a key lesson is that any legislative mandate to adopt risk assessment tools must go hand in glove with careful research, clear policy direction, and an unequivocal commitment to reevaluation. Another key lesson is that even the most carefully prepared tools can fail to be implemented fairly without careful communication and engagement with the local community. So that kind of careful research, policy direction, engagement with the local community is exactly what we're trying to contribute to in this project. So let me pause there to see if you have any questions. And then I have some questions for discussion. Clara, am I right? Sarah, am I right that we have about another 10 minutes or so?
Yes.
So I'd be happy to take your questions.
Professor Hirsch, I don't know if it's a question, but maybe a comment or something for you to think about as you explore how trial judges interpret and use assessments. You may also want to consider whether there have been any courts of appeals that have dictated to the trial courts how they're to use this assessment. And I can tell you from personal experience that the Second District Court of Appeals has given comment and direction to our Common Pleas Court as to what the ORAS system scores to be used and how it's to be used, and that it's a tool but not a a directive. And so, you know, you balance that with CBCF, community-based correctional facility admissions programming, where the ORAS score is the determinative, or at least one of the determinative factors for admission into the facility. So there's a, you know, sometimes trial judges, and I don't know how you acquire this information across the state, but you know, those are maybe some concepts that you may want to think about. What sources use it as a concrete determinative factor, and what sources suggest to the trial judges that they are to be used as a tool in their analysis?
You think we would be best able to collect information on those directives by talking to trial judges in the various districts or by talking to the District Court of Appeals?
I don't know that this will directly answer your question. I guess what I'm saying is I want you to be aware that trial judges are given instruction from agencies or from entities outside of the individual judge's own method of looking at how we want to use this. So, for example, DRC says you have to use it in this fashion to get somebody into a CBCF, but there's appellate case law that suggests to the judge you don't use it in such a directive manner. And yep. So I'm just saying, I would respectfully suggest that your inquiry be maybe broader than maybe you had initially thought, that it rests just with a trial judge.
I think that's a great suggestion. And I think it'd be very useful, in fact, important for us to understand the current guidance that trial judges have received from their courts of appeal. So thank you for mentioning that. We'll be sure to include that.
Any other questions for a professor?
May I pose a couple of questions to the group and see if folks have thoughts?
Certainly.
Okay, thanks. Going back to my slides here. So, you know, this is a nice opportunity for me to meet with this group that brings so much experience and expertise to these issues. So I thought I would take advantage of it just to get your input a bit. You know, since we are doing this for the commission, you know, what would you most like to learn from this study? What would be most useful to you? And then, as I mentioned, you know, how do we best enlist Ohio judges? How can we best frame this so that they see this as something that is useful for the criminal justice system and something that they're willing to give their time to for an interview or a survey? I've listed some stakeholders that, you know, seems to me we will want to engage. Are there others that you think we should add to that list? I listed a number of questions that we are going to start with, and I'm sure our list of questions will grow as we progress with this research, but are there other questions you think we should be asking? And how can this study ultimately be most impactful? So I'd welcome your thoughts on any of these topics.
Comments from the group?
This is Beth Capelli. I'm the judge at Fairborn Municipal Court. If you're looking at how are these utilized pretrial for bond or bail, I would strongly urge you to utilize municipal courts, mm-hmm. Since we set so much of the bond. And truthfully, we're the ones who probably don't have as many resources for probation to do the pretrial risk assessments. We do. I worked with Sarah actually to get that going. But a lot may not, and that's going to be part of their concern is how do we do this as maybe a single judge court and we don't have as many probation officers. Just one facet of it.
Thank you. That's a really good suggestion. Thanks. I want to make sure that we don't miss that important use of these tools.
This is Judge Fregali. I'm a family court judge, and I agree with Judge Capelli. I think the focus should be on the municipal courts and county court judges, because they're the first level that usually set bail in most of these criminal type proceedings. Now, I know common pleas judges also do that, but I think the initial blush should go before the municipal courts and the county courts.
Thank you, Judge. That's really useful. And hearing it from two of you, that's very good information for us.
As far as stakeholders, I would suggest somebody, I don't know what group, you would not know that better than me, but somebody that deals with poverty issues.
Mm-hmm.
Since that seems to be usually the primary focus of bond and bail reform.
Mm-hmm. So
the person can afford to get out. It'd be nice to include thoughts.
In other words, for reform of a cash bail system?
How this would be utilized in a cash bail system, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Thanks.
Other comments?
If anybody, you know, develops thoughts later and wants to share with me, please, you know, feel free to send me an email. Sarah's got my email address, or you can find it on the Moritz College of Law website. But this input already has been useful, so I'd welcome additional thoughts from this group if you have them going forward.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Hirsch, for your presentation.
Sure. Thank you for joining me. And my thanks to Sarah and also Judge Zamuda for their assistance as we, you know, formulated this project and thought about it. And that's been very valuable to us. So appreciate it. You'll be hearing more from us on this research.
Thank you.
Okay.
Next on our agenda, we're pleased to have Commission Member Sean Gallagher, Judge of the Court of Appeals for the 8th District. He's going to share some challenges and opportunities with regard to some legislation. Your Honor.
Thank you, Nick. I'm going to kind of rely on Scott to help me along with this. We have a very short presentation. It's only about 10 slides. But I thought it might be a good time for the Sentencing Commission to have a look at what's happening with Reagan Tokes right now on the ground in terms of appellate review and challenges. It's hard to believe it's been 27 months since the law's enactment on March 22nd of 2019. And the pandemic really didn't stop the clamoring about whether the law was or was not constitutional. So what I'd like to do is just kind of go through briefly a short overview of what these challenges to Reagan Tokes involve, how they're being presented, and where we're at in terms of statewide the law and the challenges to the law. And if there are any legislators on this call or on the video or on the rather the PowerPoint, I think this might help a little bit to give some insight into what happens when you do pass a bill and it becomes law and we go from there. So Scott, if we can go to the first primary slide. So right out of the gate, it wasn't long after the adoption of Reagan Tokes when the governor signed, it became effective on March 22nd, 2019, that we already had challenges to it. Very quickly, immediately, there were clamorings that it's unconstitutional. That's really all we heard from many corners, not just the defense bar, but I think some prosecutors didn't really care for the bill. And certainly, surprisingly, a lot of judges didn't care for it. One particular judge in the Common Pleas Court in Hamilton County wrote a 9-page opinion outlining why he felt the law was unconstitutional in the state of Ohio versus O'Neill. And this Common Pleas Court decision really became the groundswell, I think, where a lot of other entities started to look to that and use it for claims that the bill was unconstitutional. Now, when you talk about something like the Reagan Tokes law, it's important to remember it was a pretty expansive bill. It was 435 pages long. It adopted 5 new revised code sections. It amended 57 other sections of the revised code. And it essentially returned Ohio to indefinite sentencing for felony 1 and 2 offenses. I'm old, so I remember the days before Senate Bill 2. I was a county prosecutor then, and I remember the old days when we had indefinite sentencing across the board. And we basically sentenced, and they went to the institution. And I remember the common refrain from defendants in those days was, how much time am I going to do? And my common refrain answer was, the parole board will tell you how much time you will do. And that seemed to be acceptable to everybody. And of course, Senate Bill 2 came along, and we were left with so-called truth in sentencing. So this is where we're at. But the unconstitutional clamoring began with this decision out of Hamilton County, and we move from there. So Scott, let's go to the next one real quick. So the first question right out of the gate that was being raised in all this is the Reagan Tokes law even ripe for review? And I'll touch on that in a moment in the next slide. But the other claims that principally are being raised against Reagan Tokes law are whether it violates the Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury, whether it violates the Fifth Amendment due process clause, and whether it violates the separation of power doctrine from the US Constitution. Now, we'll touch on all of these 4 elements, but these are the key elements. If you want to understand what are the challenges being raised regarding Reagan Tokes, these are those challenges. So let's go to the next one, Scott. So ripeness, let's deal with ripeness first. Essentially, the ripeness claim is largely being raised by prosecutors across the state. They're asserting, particularly the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office is asserting, that the Reagan Tokes law is not ripe for review because the critical portion of the law that is drawing such ire is the denial of the presumption of release when the defendant is finished with the minimum term, and then there's a determination of whether ODRC will keep that inmate to the full term using up to the maximum, the indefinite maximum. As all of you know, Reagan Tokes reintroduced indefinite sentencing. 29-29-144 is the critical formula statute that they created, borrowing from the original recodification work to get us back to indefinite sentencing for qualifying felonies of the first and second degree. So the argument is essentially that because we don't know at the time of sentencing, and we don't know when the defendant initially files an appeal, whether he or she is going to be held by ODRC for the balance of that maximum term once they get to the presumptive release date at the end of their minimum terms. And because we don't know that, the argument essentially is that it's not ripe for review. Well, interestingly, the Sixth District, in a case that was actually heard by judges from the Fifth District sitting in the Sixth District because of a conflict, decided that the matter was not ripe for review in State v. Maddox. Now, other districts, the Second and 12th specifically, found that the case is ripe for review, right? And the law is ripe for review, and they wrote about that previously. So we did have a conflict. The Supreme Court has taken this. And if you're interested, next Tuesday, June 29th, the court will hear arguments on this, but it will only be on the ripeness question, not on any of the other constitutional challenges. This was the one scenario I was hoping we wouldn't get to where we had these challenges parsed out into separate issues. I was hoping that we could have a case where they could hear it all in one bucket, but as we know, the law doesn't always work that way. Now, what's interesting about this ripeness argument is, and certainly Scott and I have talked about this at great lengths, Sarah as well, is State v. Henderson, which came out last October, and most of you are aware that that modified the longstanding void voidable doctrine. And it now requires issues that be timely appealed by both sides, or the claims will be barred either by jurisdictional impediments or by res judicata. So the question is that if it's not ripe for review initially at the time of the appeal, and a defendant doesn't appeal it or can't appeal it, how and when and under what circumstances would a defendant ever be able to appeal the constitutionality of a new law that is adopted like this? Henderson makes clear that both sides have to appeal immediately, timely, and if you don't do so, you're really caught in that very narrow window under post-conviction proceedings as to what you can challenge and when. So let's go to the next one, Scott. And this will take us to our first substantive challenge that is being raised by the defense bar dealing with the Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury. Essentially, this claim is that because the ODRC is essentially assessing inmate conduct at the institution level, that is part of the punishment aspect that's being played into the maximum sentence. And therefore, it's being extended in a way that was not determined by the jury. This is very much like the old Blakely v. Washington, Apprendi, Allende, and our own State v. Foster, those of you who remember judicial fact-finding, if you will. This is kind of what's being asserted in this. It also claims within this Sixth Amendment right to a trial by jury, we see in many of the briefing on this issue that they're claiming that Reagan-Tokes is similar to the old bad time law that was initiated in Senate Bill 2 that was previously found to be unconstitutional in the Bray case back in 2000. Now, the biggest problem with this argument from the perspective of someone, and I have written on Reagan-Tokes already, so I'm not revealing anything. I found the law to be constitutional and believe it's also ripe for review. But to take the opposite side of the claims in this, the problem with the argument is that it really reinforces the misconception, in my view, that ODRC is extending a prison sentence when, in fact, that prison sentence was already imposed, both the minimum and the maximum, by the trial court using the formulas in 29-29-144C. So the argument, the counter-argument would be ODRC really isn't extending anything or imposing a term beyond what a jury could find, but rather is making what is similar to a parole determination. It's kind of parole turned on its head. We're going to keep you or rather than let you out based on a set of criteria that would not be that much different than what the parole board would do. So let's go to the next one, Scott. Now, this is the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause argument, and essentially, and all the challenges center on 2967-271, which is kind of the Reagan-Tokes presumption of release statute, and most of the briefing focuses and directs itself on that section. So We know that 2967-271 provides offenders with the right to a hearing before the imposition of that maximum term that was created under 2929-144, but the statute doesn't really delineate exactly how the inmate's rights will be addressed at the institution level. So the natural reaction is there's a due process problem here because the statute didn't outline exactly how a defendant's rights would be protected. Now, again, the counter argument to this is that ODRC under 5120.01 is authorized to set up rules, regulations, proceedings, and processes by legislative decree. They're allowed to do that. The question is do all those have to be in the actual statute, 2967-271, in order for us to say that the defendant is afforded proper due process rights? Now, to throw a little monkey wrench into this, further, subsequent to the filing of a lot of these briefs and subsequent to the enactment of the law by nearly a year, nearly 2 years, ODRC finally established all the procedural safeguards through its authority under 5120.01 to comply with the constitutional requirements. And you can go online and read these. They become available. They were adopted effective March 15th, 2021, and they're available on the website for ODRC. You can see them. They're pretty exhaustive. They're more than 10 pages long. In hearings, the defendant does have a right to be present, and there are various other determinations. But to a facial challenge under due process, the question is, does the statute have to delineate all these, or can ODRC do it in the form of these policy determinations? So that's essentially the due process arguments being raised against the law. All right, let's go to the next one, Scott, if we can. And this is the separation of powers doctrine argument that comes up. And essentially, it's not that dissimilar to the jury trial argument, but what the argument is that the claim is that ODRC is extending an inmate's prison term by imposing an additional term of imprisonment beyond which was imposed by the sentencing court. And therefore, this represents a usurping of judicial power by an executive agency, namely ODRC. So it's a pretty classic argument that, you know, the executive branch is basically conducting a judicial sentencing in denying the presumption of release and maintaining an inmate up through the end of the maximum term. Now, the argument against this is similar to the earlier arguments that it is the trial court, not ODRC, that's imposing that maximum term. So the argument would be, ODRC is not really imposing a maximum term. It's already been imposed by the trial court. They're simply reinforcing the sentence that has previously been imposed. And this is not that dissimilar to the executive branch's authority to release offenders from sentences under Ohio's parole system. A lot of the arguments from prosecutors' offices are focusing on the Woods-Telb decision, which dealt with PRC. You'll recall that there was a great challenge to PRC originally back in the early 2000s, late 90s, when we first got into play with this, and eventually PRC was found to be constitutional. The trial court makes the advisement, and then DRC will determine whether you're going at it in certain circumstances if it's not mandatory. So those are the three major arguments: the right to a trial by jury, the separation of powers, and due process. So let's go to the next one here. And this is this slide I picked out primarily for Judge Zamuda. those of you that don't live in Cleveland, you'll know that we are often jokingly around the state referred to the great state of Cuyahoga and all kinds of other enumerated acronyms that are used. But I like to use the People's Republic of the 8th District. And a little Soviet humor is always good. When I put this together, Scott and I tried to guess who these people were, and we got two out of the three. We had trouble with the guy in the middle, and I'll just tell you, the guy on the far right, your far right, is obviously Brezhnev. I think he was the fourth Soviet leader, and the guy on the far left is Chernenko, who replaced Brezhnev, and the guy in the middle actually is a guy named, I have to get his name right, it's Tikhonov, who wanted to replace Chernenko or Andropov, but he got pushed out by Gorbachev. And then we all know what happened. But the 8th District is kind of a crazy place in the sense that we have 12 judges and we sit in panels of three. And on any given day, we can have three hearings going on simultaneously. And sometimes we're hearing the same issue and don't know what the other panels are working on. Well, we don't really know. So it makes for a fun outcome oftentimes in our district. So let's go to the next slide. So here's what happened in our district relative to Reagan Tokes. And I'm using the 8th because we have been the most, driven, if you will, on this topic of Reagan Tokes and whether it's unconstitutional or constitutional. We've released to date 6 decisions. Many appellate districts around the court haven't even touched these issues. We've touched on all of them, from due process, separation of powers, ripeness. We've covered the gamut in all these cases. Now, you'll see that 2 cases, the first case, Del Valle, which found Reagan Tokes to be unconstitutional. I think the thing went down for a moment. There it is. And the last case, Gamble, were released on the same day, May 27th. I wrote Gamble and Judge Mays wrote Duvalier, and we came to opposite conclusions. I found the statute was ripe for review and it was constitutional on all 3 grounds. She found that while it was ripe for review, it was unconstitutional on all 3 grounds. So what happens? Well, we have a very committed en banc process in our district. So we immediately convened an en banc review of all 12 judges, and we voted on June 15th to conduct an en banc, and we have frozen the release of any other Reagan Tokes cases until we internally reach a decision on the conflict between Duvalier and Gamble. Now, interestingly, no other districts besides the 8th have found any part of the Reagan Tokes law unconstitutional. The 2nd and 12th have found it fully constitutional, and the 3rd has found parts of it constitutional, those parts that were raised in front of it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. Let's go to the next slide, Scott. The thing about Reagan Tokes that I thought I would touch on that I think is important, these are things that are represent both opportunities and observations. The first one that I want to point out to everybody is that, especially to the legislatures on the call, is that the challenges have largely ignored the errors in sentencing computation on determining the maximum term or even applying the indefinite terms. Scott and I have talked with Leanne Bowers at ODRC, and we've reviewed a number of journal entries from around the state. And I got to tell you, the error record on these things is pretty high. There are many, many, many mistakes being made in the computation and in how, for example, some judges are giving indefinite terms on every count within a file containing, let's say, 5 convictions, instead of just giving 1 indefinite term on the count that is under 29-29-144 should contain the maximum term. So we're seeing a lot of problems with that. And those are not really being raised yet because most of the defense bar is focused on the constitutional challenges right now. But it won't be long before these challenges, if the bill is found to be constitutional, will be focused on the math errors. And they are significant. Now, an opportunity that I can talk about is that House Bill 166 does have some cleanup language that would make the computations much easier. But whether House Bill 166 will ever see the light of day, I don't know. I wish somebody could grab parts of that bill and go for a quick fix if this law is indeed constitutional. The other thing that is kind of disturbing about these challenges in this bill is that all the challenges to date are, it's all or nothing. Everybody has pushed all their poker chips into the center of the table. This is unlike anything I've seen before. And I was around for the Blakely challenges, the Senate Bill 2 back in State v. Foster, where most of the focus was on, look, we just need to get rid of this part of the law or that part of the law. There was clearly a recognition of severability on unconstitutional provisions. That's not happening with Reagan Tokes. Those that believe it's unconstitutional believe all 455 pages are unconstitutional, and they say it's got to go away in totality. So that's really a very, very unusual world that we're seeing. The other thing that I want to touch on about it is that because at least I see the Reagan-Tokes law so closely mirroring the parole process and factual determinations that ODRC makes to determine parole, I question whether our whole traditional indefinite sentencing model on rapes involving minors or murder charges might also be threatened by an unconstitutional determination of Reagan-Tokes. Same with the parole system. I mean, if they can't make, if they're not allowed to make a determination on keeping an inmate in on a presumption of release, then what right do they have to make a decision on releasing an inmate before the full term is ended? So it's going to be interesting to see how that is handled once it does get to the Supreme Court. Now, one of the things I do want to touch on and be very positive about Senate Bill 201 is that I think it's really a good start towards moving to an incentive-based model or system to create good time reductions for defined behavior or rehabilitative efforts. I say that because back in the old days when I was a prosecutor, before Senate Bill 2, when you went to prison, you got like something like 30% good time credit just for being an inmate. If you had a pulse, you got like 30% of your time off. And they also had those other provisions about, you know, what they called, I called it inmates between the ages of like 18 and 24 got further reductions beyond what older inmates got. But one of the things that I think is missed by Senate Bill 201 is this. If you're an inmate sentenced under Senate Bill 201 and you behave, you actually can earn 5 or 15% reduction in your sentence. And as far as I can tell, that's not eligible to offenders who went to prison the day before Reagan-Tokes became law on the same charges that a Reagan-Tokes inmate would be serving. So there is an incentive in Reagan-Tokes law for inmates, which indeed down the road could be expanded to further reduce the prison population in a healthy way and still maintain that sense of truth in sentencing where we're not just giving away free time for nothing. So that's my update on it. We're going to see where it goes. Eventually, the Supreme Court will get all three probably constitutional challenges in one form or another. Hopefully, they get them in one case. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Scott and Sarah and see if they want to talk any further about it.
Well, thanks, Judge Gallagher. We appreciate your effort, and you and Scott and Judge Routson do what I would consider a clinic when it comes to these topics. So we appreciate it. I'd be interested to know from the group your response. I think just laying it out is helpful, but I feel like as the commission, we probably ought to talk about what next steps are. And Judge Savaggio, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, I guess the first thing I would ask for is whether anyone has any direct thoughts about the questions posed by Judge Gallagher or Sarah. I don't see any hands up, or I will, maybe I can start some discussion. Number one, Sean, that was an excellent presentation, and you really concisely and clearly set out some of the challenges we have. I can also tell the group that based on an earlier conversation I had through email with Sean and Scott, that there are some parts of the Reagan-Tokes legislation that send some conflicting messages to judges when sentencing under Ohio's sexual violent predator law in 2971-03. And ironically, I had a rape case that I was preparing to take a potential plea on, where actually sentencing someone under 2971-03, I was charged with giving less advisements to the offender than I would if the offender was being sentenced under Reagan-Tokes for a different section of the rape statute. And what it just illustrated for me is that we have, for whatever reason, really caused ourselves some problems when it comes to navigating some of Ohio's most serious felony offenses. That's number one. Number two, Sean touched on, and I would reemphasize that, you know, back in December of 2017, I had raised the commission with the commission when we were discussing Reagan-Tokes, my concern that math was going to become a challenge for judges. And, you know, a lot of these cases, particularly in rural counties or high profile cases, and the last thing that you want is a math error to be reason to bring everybody back into court. And it really should not be this complicated. It shouldn't be. And I don't know if some of the complexity is due to the formula or some of the complexity is due to blended sentencing methods of indefinite sentencing on some offenses and definite sentencing on other offenses. But, you know, there are parts to Sean's presentation that I think we do have opportunities to maybe look at a holistic approach to Ohio sentencing. And, you know, and whether we should go back to sentencing that occurred back in 1991, when I was an optimistic litigant coming out of law school. And we've got a lot of opportunity, and Sean, thank you for pointing some of those things out. Any other comments or thoughts? It's a quiet group today.
Judge Salvaggio, this is Scott. I would just note that, you know, what Judge Salvaggio was saying there, for if you're not familiar with the ins and outs of the rape sentencing statutes, is that it's there are less advisements when you're sentencing someone to a life sentence as a sexually violent predator than there are if you were sentencing someone on a F2 burglary, which, you know, could seem incongruent to some people. And the second thing I would just mention that I dropped it into chat. If you are interested in more information on the appellate cases, I did post a link to the commission's tracking document there in the chat. We do update that every time a new decision is handed down.
Thank you, Scott. Anything else? All right. At this time on the agenda, we have the opportunity to have some of our legislative priorities and perspectives offered by our General Assembly members. I see that Senator Thomas, and I thought I saw Senator Manning at one point was on. Yes. So this would be an opportunity to hear from you if there's something you would like to offer.
Hello, this is Nathan Manning. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, I apologize. I'm driving down for session today. Hopefully we're finishing out the budget here shortly and heading off the summer break where we can work on some of these big issues and work with Sentencing Commission and all the great experts that are on this call and across the state. But, you know, in terms of the budget, there is some criminal justice things in there. TCAP was always a top conversation on both the House side and Senate side. And currently it's in conference committee trying to figure out where we're going to land on that. The House passed it as mandatory across the state for F5s. The Senate removed the mandatory for F5s. They expanded it as an opt-in for F4. So that's an ongoing discussion that could be resolved here sometime today or certainly by early next week. And then in Judiciary Committee in the Senate, we've been hearing a lot of testimony. We were in committee till I think 8:30 last week, hearing testimony on bail reform, the death penalty, getting rid of the death penalty in Ohio. This week we heard a lot of testimony on Senate Bill 90, which is the strangulation bill in Ohio that's been around for a number of years. So we have some, you know, big topics that we're working on in judiciary, and hopefully we'll be able to work through the summer with all of you to get some of those resolved.
Thank you, Senator Manning. Senator Thomas, did you wish to offer some thoughts? Doesn't appear that he does. Are there any questions for Senator Manning? I don't see any hands raised. So, Senator Manning, thank you very much for your presentation. Safe travels to you.
Thanks so much, and have a great weekend here almost.
All right. We'll now turn to the House Bill 1 Implementation Work Group. We have Laura and Nikki and Todd, and I don't know who wants to take the mantle of discussion, but I'll start maybe with Laura.
Good morning, everybody. This is going to be a nice quick update. I'm going to mostly turn this over to Nikki and Todd to let them talk about what they've been doing. But for the group's general information, just want to let you know that we've had a number of committee meetings. We have broken them down by topic matter that are covered by House Bill 1. We discussed the changes that were made to record sealing, intervention in lieu, probate for substance abuse disorders and technical violations. We have an upcoming meeting on Tuesday where we're going to hear from the Ohio Access to Justice on record sealing issues and issues pertaining to how individuals who interface with the record sealing system are finding House Bill 1 and its impacts. But as to the actual specifics regarding data collection and where we are with amassing the information, I'm going to turn it over first to Nikki.
Thanks, Laura. Yes, Laura gave a great overview about what we've been doing. I think it's been a pretty interesting group to work with. It's very active and a lot of different viewpoints. And as we probably all on this call know, there's not one big source of statewide data that we can go to evaluate the impact of HB1. So in order to address this, we've decided to just get as many streams of data and multiple data sources for each of these topics. So regarding record sealing, we are obtaining any available information from BCI, including the total sealing and expungement orders a year, approximate revenue generated by record sealing, the time it takes to process each sealing, and if possible, the time between conviction and sealing. The Attorney General's office is currently undergoing a system upgrade, so we are waiting on that information until I think July, when that is supposed to be finished. We're also asking to, we've contacted court administrators in municipal and common pleas courts to ask for information on motions to seal records, motions granted, motions denied. We sent a letter out on May 21st. We received some concerns that courts were not comfortable and we did not have to inspect sealed records, which is correct. And we clarified that we weren't looking to inspect the records, but merely to have an understanding of what records, how many records were sealed, and then establishing a baseline so that we can see how HB1 has changed that. And as Laura talked about, the last kind of stream of data for record sealing is this discussion with Access to Justice Foundation next week. Regarding the probate measures in HB1 about involuntary commitment to treatment, we are collecting information from local Adam H boards about the available facilities for such commitments. Questions in our work groups that came up again and again as an issue that if courts were doing this more, there has to be some place for these individuals to go, and that those facilities may be very limited in the state. So we're trying to understand where these opportunities are. We have plans to interview probate judges that have used involuntary commitment before HB1, as well as those that maybe are using it for the first time after HB1 or have not yet, but to understand their experience and their thoughts about this legislation and about these changes, as well as we will be interviewing treatment providers about their awareness of changes to HB1, since they are obviously part of this. We'd like to get their thoughts and their perspective on how these changes will impact substance use disorder and those that may be committed to this treatment. We plan to have a survey slash report at the end of the year that we ask for from probate judges to get a sense of how many of these types of cases they've seen since HB1 has been enacted. That's a little more specific than is currently collected from the case management reports. So it's gonna have to be a separate collection. And then in Cuyahoga County, one of the staff members of the probate court is tracking the amount of informal inquiries she receives about commitment to treatment versus then how many petitions they receive to see. There's been a lot of talk about the barriers of involuntary commitment to treatment. And so we'll be able to hopefully see a little bit if the changes in HB1 have removed some of those primary barriers. So I will turn it over to Todd to talk about the other topics in HB1 and our collection efforts there.
Sure, thank you, Nikki. The other topics include intervention in lieu of conviction and technical violations. Similar to record sealing, we have asked a variety of sources for data on ILC. I believe we'll be getting some ILC data from BCI on dispositions. Along with our letter to court administrators on record sealing, we also requested some aggregate case data on ILC from municipal and common pleas courts across the state as well. And the last source of data on the actual hard numbers is from ODRC for their APA supervised counties. Just really to get, for the first time ever, a sense of baseline numbers on what ILC across the state looks like. Along with that, we received a lot of feedback saying that, you know, that the data that we may receive on ILC will not tell the full story because there's so many nuances and caveats and things happening that wouldn't be captured by a case management system. And we wanted to be very cognizant of that. So we started another project beginning in June where we've been doing focus group interviews with stakeholders across the state at the municipal and common pleas level. We've talked to judges, court administrators, prosecutors, defense attorneys, and some others I'm sure I'm missing in geographically representative areas. And the last interview we did for that concluded on Monday. So now we are processing and digesting the results of those interviews. And our goal is to write up the report on common themes and recommendations to present at our August House Bill 1 work group meeting. And I will say, although we have found that ILC operates very differently from every jurisdiction we've talked to, there are a lot of common themes and recommendations that we seem to be hearing from everyone. So I'm excited to get that report generated. Along with that, I don't think we mentioned the report on the impacts of House Bill 1. First report is due in December of this year, and then we're required to report on the impacts every 2 years thereafter. So certainly we'll be sharing the results of that when it's due in December. The last topic that Nikki mentioned was community control and technical violations. And I might need Scott to help me out because we had our meeting on this topic last week and a good chunk of it was sort of sussing out what exactly the bill will impact in terms of defining technical violations. So from that meeting, we're still determining really how to best assess the impact of the change in definitions, but we'll be certainly meeting with ODRC to get their data on supervision to see the who's coming in on technical versus non-technical violations. I think that is the summary of all our topics we're studying.
Thank you, Todd. And I think I can tell the entire group as they're continuing to gather the data, the two main themes are kind of coming out of the entirety of the project. One, something that's not, you know, unknown to this group, the lack of consistent data collection source and lack of commonality of terms and things that are being collected. As you can see, the staff is doing an amazing job trying to find a whole bunch of different ways to gather the information that we've been charged under House Bill 1 with acquiring in order to measure impact. But that has been greatly complicated by the lack of one, you know, data source from which this information can be gathered and assessed and amassed. So I think we're seeing that. The second thing that we're seeing, again, the complexity of these various statutory provisions, there seems to be a lack of implementation consistently across the state. Some of it is lack of awareness of the change in the law. Some of it is just the local differences between and among different court systems and different judges. But of course, that also makes it difficult to fully measure the impact. And the last thing, I actually said there are only two, but the last thing is also about the difficulty in gathering information from the individuals that are actually intended to be assisted by the changes in House Bill 1. How do we determine whether or not we're actually getting to the community service providers and the individuals who themselves need access to either the probate, substance abuse treatment, to record sealing, or pension in lieu? Are there barriers before they even actually hit the court system with these changes? And that's, of course, extremely difficult to kind of measure, but I want to applaud the staff because they're doing their damnedest. So that's where we're at right now. I don't know if Sarah or Scott wanted to add anything else, but if not, that's my report.
No, I think you guys did great, and thank you.
Any questions for Lara or Nikki or Todd? So speak now. Nope. Well, great job, Laura and staff. All right. Last but not least on our agenda, we have two very patient men, Judge Zamuda and Dr. Saeed. Hazem, nice to see you again, sir. And they're going to speak about an update to the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform and the website. Your honors.
Thank you, Judge Savaggio. So, good morning, everyone. Good to be with you all again. I believe this is our third or fourth update as it relates to the Sentencing Data Platform. There's no truth to the rumor that you did this alphabetically because my name is saddled with Z. We're last. Is that right, Sarah? Because I'm used to that, you know.
Yeah, I know.
I have scars from, you know, what is it, 12 years of schooling where I sat last seat, last row. But I'll get over that. In any event, we have before today told you where we are on it. And I think the best way to summarize our current position on relative to this particular project is to say we continue to exceed even our growing expectations because of the demand for courts and their willingness to attempt to integrate their particular sentencing program and structure using the data platform. And I would be remiss, you know, one of the benefits of going last is I've been able to hear all the wonderful presentations before. My engagement on behalf of the Sentencing Commission as relates to the platform has also given me an opportunity to see firsthand on a regular basis just how hard a staff the Sentencing Commission, starting with Sarah, Nikki, Todd, and Scott, how hard they work. And you see that when you look at all of this. And Sarah, I have to take a moment to say one more thing here before I get into the specifics, because it's important that I think we publicly recognize this and that the commission members frame it appropriately. Sarah sent out on 6-4 a new resources guide that hopefully all of you have received. And when you look at that guide, that alone is the work of what a full-time sentencing commission normally does. The updates in the Ohio Sentencing Data Platform that we're going to talk about, the website in particular, Felony Sentencing Reference Guide, adult right restoration recording sealing booklet, updating and modernizing actually a Supreme Court of Ohio criminal justice opinion summary, instrumental in helping facilitate the Ohio Supreme Court itself change and modify the method by which parties, interested individuals, courts can access existing cases to try and understand pending issues that are pending before that court. Scott just posted in the chat, as he mentioned earlier, they've created a tracking tool so that as Reagan Toke cases are being decided by appellate courts and are being accepted for review by the Supreme Court, courts can access, participants, attorneys can access that information. It's just overwhelming, the level and the amount of work. And I think it clearly points to something that I hope Senator Manning is still with us, recognizes the import that it's really not the Sentencing Commission, but the Criminal Justice Commission. And kudos to Sarah and her staff for all the hard work that they continue to do and are adding to that, not standing pat with what they've done in the past. I think I would be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity, and I hope I don't make Sarah mad, but I think it's worth the recognition, Sarah. Thank you. All right, so as it relates to the data platform, I just said that we continue to exceed our expectations. I think the biggest development for all of your considerations, because we are into show and tells these days, especially through Zoom, is we now have a vibrant up and running data platform website. And through the wonders of technology, Scott, can you help share that? Because really the website helps display where we were, where we are, and where we're headed in terms of the meaning behind the platform, the opportunities. And Scott, if you can pull up the, there we go. So this is the homepage when you pull up the website. And as you scroll through, and we don't need to go through all of that right now, I would encourage all of you to review and look at that. Your input and feedback is appreciated. And then what I want to do is take you to the, I believe it's Join the Project, if I'm not mistaken. So this page of Join the Project, it gives you the documents that we're employing. And remember what we're trying to do here. What we're trying to do is we're attempting to create from sentencing documents and convert them to computer program. And that's what those documents are that are being done through the aid and assistance of Dr. Saeed. And you can access that and review those. We will keep everyone apprised of the current version so that you will always see, and thank you, Scott, for sharing that. As we update the versions to conform to changes in the law, clarifications, areas where we may not have correctly cited or we missed particular parts of felony sentence, to clarify and make sure that use form that we utilize is always the most current, up-to-date, correct statement of felony sentence in Ohio. That's the premise by which we're operating. The next slide down, if you go down, next page, I should say, this tells you how vibrant we is. When we started this less than a year ago, I have, you know, that last fall, it was our goal to go to one court, to find one judge in one court, to see whether or not our idea could actually bear fruit and would work in a particular court. From that one individual, and that's Allen County Judge Jeff Reed, he's spoken with this group last time, was unable to be here again today, but this is how we've grown exponentially, quite frankly. And this is up to date as of yesterday, because we now have not just Judge Reed in Allen County, but we have three other courts that are signed on to implement and to begin the process of incorporating the use and the platform, therefore, in their actual felony sentence work. It's hard work and it takes a lot of time because we're committed to doing it piecemeal through each court. And when I say that, what I really mean, it's important that everyone understands this. We're not trying to dictate how courts should change their practice. Rather, we're trying to make sure that the court's existing practice that the integrity of what it takes for a particular trial judge, Judge McIntosh in Franklin County, Judge Salvaggio in Champaign County, how they perform the process of imposing a felony sentence can be grafted into our program as opposed to the other way around. And that's why it takes time, but that's something that we're committed to because that's really the best way. And that's why it's an iterative process as we learn with each successive visit. That's where we stand. You can see the courts that where we have been and where we're headed to. I'm particularly excited, Summit County, we were recently there, and I'll have Hazem speak about that in particular. And that's because there are 10 judges in Summit County and all 10 judges said, yes, we would like to try using this use in our court. How do we do that? That's going to be our biggest challenge because obviously it's the largest court. We recently met with the judges in Cuyahoga County and we're about to go there. Or I think we're trying to figure out a date that we can come in. And if I'm not mistaken, we're up to eight of the 32 judges in Cuyahoga County are signed on for this pilot program there. Excited about that. Hazem, I'll let you take over because you're the secret sauce. I just frame it for you and you sell it.
Thank you, Judge. I wanted to, just as a quick reminder, we have been working off of a roadmap. And so we envision the project to continue to evolve and grow in multiple dimensions, building the system itself, integrating more standard forms, visiting and piloting and implementing with different judges and courts and adapting to them and building the dashboards as well as the governance where decisions on what data elements should be included, how the data should be presented and so on. All of this is continuing in the conversation. When we started a few months ago, we thought we are doing a tiny bit piece of the kickoff, but very quickly the momentum is driving the project and it's continued to grow. And we're positioning ourselves to start the launch phase July 1st, and we're very hopeful that this will go as planned. Based on the visit we had, we think that at a very high level, 30,000 level view, we think that to seamlessly integrate with a court, we will need these steps to first get the data about the case from the court into our system, and then updating the sentencing or generating a sentence entry based on information about the case. So the judge and the judge's staff will be utilizing our system to generate the Word document that represents the sentence entry from our system. And in that exchange, we retain the data elements about the sentence in our database, and the court receives the entry document that they can then take and continue to implement in their phases. At this very high level, so far we visited 13 courts, 23 judges. We think this high level applies everywhere. Where differences and changes come as to when within the court process they start interacting with our system and who will be utilizing the system to generate the entry. In some cases, the judge themselves utilize the system as they prepare for the hearing and then post the hearing. In some other cases, the staff can do that based on whatever existing, based on the existing communication and exchanges of information between the judge and the staff, and we're adapting that. Another area is how the case information comes into our system. We now have a method to incorporate a standard report out of the case management system. We have a method where it can be manually added, and we continue to explore as we visit courts different ways to do that. We seem to have coalesced around that this system is about the story and discovering the story. And this is a much larger concept than just sentence data. Because when you mention sentence data, oftentimes the thinking goes to, at least from a public perspective, to a number. this person is sentenced to X or Y, and we start to comparing X and Y against other numbers like age, race, and so on. But the reality is it's a much more bigger a story than just some numbers. And through different discussions in the project teams, we're exploring this concept. And the framework we're utilizing to explore that concept is learn first. And that's where we visit judges and learn from them, both their decision-making process, the information they rely on, and the actual workflow that they implement, and then incorporate that into the how our system will assist the judge in generating the entry, and then we pilot that system and deploy it. So we have now, I believe, as I mentioned, 23 judges that we engaged in the learning phase. We have 4 judges that are currently in the pilot phase, and I'm hopeful that by the end of the summer, some of them will go in the deploy phase where we start actually collecting some data. It is worth noting that we are collecting the data now, and since this process is a forward-looking process, dashboards and data analysis will happen later on in the roadmap, not immediately at this time. And as we, once we had that framework, we continue to utilize it as we explore other issues like integration, learning about the offense codes and how the offense code is the glue that connects all elements of the system together, and where offense code also where a lot of the intelligence, there was a mention earlier about mathematical calculations. Once the offense code are captured in its totality, the system can do these mathematical calculations and present it to the judge for information. Very important to notice here, because in the public discourse, there's some discussion on the system telling the judge what to do. That is not really the case at all. The system is a tool among many other tools in the hands of the judge to generate the entry and assist with information sharing whenever that is possible. I did share the system in the past, but just as a reminder, this is how the entry document look in the system. Most of the information are divided into sections, and the sections becomes only available in the entry if it is selected, and that's where case uniqueness becomes is implemented. The document itself, everything you see in front of you, comes from the use. So it says here we are using version February 2021. The May 2021 version is in the process of being updated. One of the elements we mentioned earlier with respect to the story is the factors, which is a very low-hanging fruit to allow us to capture the story behind the actual numbers of the sentence. So we capture them here, even if the judge doesn't want them in the entry itself when it is generated, they can still provide it here, and that helps us as we group together what was the story behind that sentence. And the system is continually improved. It currently has only the use form, and we are working on implementing the MOC forms and the additional forms that the Judge Zamuda and the team is providing. We are now on version 1.5. 1.6 will be released later this week, and we continue to work diligently on the technical development of the system, on the incorporation of additional documents, on building additional intelligence, and facilitating the implementation process in each court, and on the expanding integration with other elements of the system as well. So I'll stop here and turn it to you, Judge Zim.
Thank you, Hazem. Excellent as always. We just wanted to let others know that, you know, because this is modeled through the Sentencing Commission, we are creatures of state government, and we, this phase that we are concluding right now really kind of dovetails with the end of the biennium. We are in the process of finalizing the details for the roadmap of the next phase, which we've now denominated as a launch phase, which starts July 1, coinciding with with the budget's approval, and hopefully the amount of resources that are dedicated in at least the current draft of the budget for the Sentencing Commission will go to help expand exponentially again this platform, so that we can launch into a far more courts and be really ready to deal with the increased demand and interest of the various courts and accommodate that and reach that critical. At some point, we anticipate in the next phase that we'll reach a critical mass of courts/judges who want to have the data platform incorporated. And that will be an exciting time, because then we'll look at transitioning to statewide coverage for the platform. Stay tuned. Questions in the meantime? Chairman Savaggio's back to you.
Thank you, Gene. And thank you, Hazam. Great presentation. I saw that Sheriff Sims had shared a comment as well with the group. At this time, Sarah, I'm going to turn it over to you and see if there's anything that you'd like to offer as a wrap-up.
Just a couple things, actually. Judge Zamuda and others on the call have mentioned the upcoming finalization of the budget. I'm not sure all of you remember that in addition to requesting funding to support the evolution of this data platform, we also have additional positions that will be added to the commission's table of organization in the upcoming budget. One is a what they call a peer position, although no one could be Scott's peer, but we'll have two criminal justice counsels. So we'll have another position similar to Scott's added to the table of organization. And we've also been approved for an assistant director position, both of which will take a very active and helpful role in the work that we're doing. As Judge Savaggio and I have talked about before, although we haven't been in the office, that doesn't mean we haven't been working. And so it'll be a great help to have a couple more, well, four more hands at our virtual tables. And that's about the only other thing I can think of to talk about this morning.
All right. Before we adjourn, then, any other comments for the good of the group? Seeing none, it's hoped that this is our last Zoom commission meeting. And Chief Justice Willing will meet in September at the Supreme Court.
Yes. Or somewhere in Columbus, you know. But we'll find space.
All right. As our speakers today have noted, I'll just leave you with this. There's plenty of opportunity for participation and feedback. And yes. I would really encourage some of the organizations that are represented here to contact those who have given presentations today and offer your comments outside this record. In hopes that we can advance the work of the commission. Yes, so with that, I hope you guys have a nice summer, and we'll see you as fall creeps upon us.